Thanks for listening to this Eastlake podcast. Everything we do is supported by the generous donations of our local and online community. If you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by visiting eastlakecc.com. We hope you enjoy this week's message.
All right. Good morning. Well, the street that runs right up here on this side of the building here is called 132nd. And if you are new to the area, if you take that road through the intersection here and up the hill and underneath the freeway a little bit further, you'll eventually be about kitty corner to Evergreen Hospital, a hospital that I have been to many times, and actually a lot recently when I was going through chemotherapy. But 18 years ago, a little baby girl turned a baby-faced boy into a father. My daughter, Riley, turns 18 years old today. And it's much more helpful in this service to not have my wife sitting right there. Because, this was the easy version. Michelle and I are beginning a new phase in our parenting. And that is, we have four kids, and one of them is now an adult. And so it's a whole different deal. When I get home today, of course, we're going to spend some family time together. But today is kind of just all throughout the weekend, I just keep thinking about it. Like, I cannot believe my daughter is 18 years old, and her boyfriend is marginally acceptable. And just kidding. I love him. Actually, he's a great guy. He's going to UW, and he's a good dude. But there's layers in this stuff. Chad, how you doing, man? I heard I love your laugh. I'm like, I know that laugh. There's layers of gravity to the day for me. Obviously, one is, you know, my daughter turns 18 today. But also, 13 years ago, my wife and I and our two little kids moved from San Diego to launch a new kind of church. Just up the road, actually in the city of Kirkland, but just up the road at what is now Kirkland Middle School. It was a brand new junior high at the time. And 13 years ago, just like now, it was the month of October that we started doing practice services for a few months. Unlike now, I was 26 and had a lot less gray hair. Actually, I started noticing it's more white, is that what my daughter said? It's not gray, it's like white. Your hair is white. Before starting this thing, I had never spoken a whole sermon in my life. And so, you know, it was not great for quite a while. I want to say thank you to people like the Irishes who stuck around for quite a while. You guys had low standards, apparently, for sticking around this long. And, you know, I do think that it's true. I mean, I wasn't good. I don't know that I'm, like, killer now. I just kind of stumble through thoughts in front of you. Maybe that's the fun part. You're just like, you never know. The guy just gets on stage and burns in front of us, and it's interesting. But I think what kept us together, what made it work, especially in those early days, because we were doing everything poorly, was there was just a high level of positive energy. We were friends. We loved each other. We were trying something fresh. We were excited about it. There was a passion and an enthusiasm to break the rules on our own terms as we cultivated a spiritual community. And that was exciting, and we were happy to do so, and didn't take ourselves too seriously. And so we wanted to know, what would it look like to create, and this is a phrase we used a lot, a church for the rest of us, which in many ways we've realized we never really fully grew into that slogan until 2015, but we grew into it all the same, especially by then. I had no idea that pastoring this church or leading this church would literally turn me inside out over the next decade of my life, but it certainly did. And today, in many ways, as I reflect on my daughter turning 18 and becoming an adult, I'm also reflecting on having taken a month break from this, which is good for me, like not only that I didn't have to do this, but I realized how much I love it and why I like being a part of a community like this. And so in today is not just about my daughter turning 18, but it's like a sort of a milestone weekend for us as a community. We much like a relationship, this church has gone through seasons, like significant different seasons. And I feel like in many ways today is a bit of a rebirth. You know, if you don't know much of our history, I'm not going to give it to you, but in many ways, over the last 3 years, we have sort of been dodging the crumbling walls of a multi-site megachurch that we once were after our crazy lead pastor dropped a bomb and said out loud some things he'd been keeping to himself. And somehow we made it through those years of just crumbling and loss and chaos. We somehow, I don't know how, but we survived and we find ourselves here today. And that's why sometimes, even as a staff, we have been jokingly referring to ourselves as Zombie Church. Like Leah the other day was like, we should just change our name to Zombie Church. I'm like, I don't know. But my son's super into zombies, so he would love that. But I like it for two reasons. I like the idea of Zombie Church because it's actually really true in two ways. Number one, you just can't seem to kill our church. Like literally a lot of things should have killed us. And we just keep sort of sneaking out, you know, you can't seem to kill us. And then two, we do like brains. And I feel like I should explain that. I feel like I should explain that. Eastlake is, if you're new around here, you should know. One, this isn't a real church, whatever that means. It's weird. We don't really care what you believe. That's true. We aren't on a mission to convert you to a specific religion. We are an inclusive, intellectually engaged, and socially active community of people who can think for themselves. And we expect and encourage people to think for themselves. We're not interested in the uniformity of thought. If you disagree with what I said today, I don't care. I mean, not in a, I don't care what you think, but in a sense, like, that's not our goal anyway, is to get us to all agree. It is to get us to think, to engage, to understand what it is that you believe and why you believe what you believe is a central part of what we're trying to do here, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So it's a little bit of a weird place. But we are convinced of this, that any kind of healthy sense of soul or healthy spirituality or healthy religion has to be more about the life you actually live than about some sort of dogmas or beliefs that you adhere to mentally. It has to change your actual life. It has to be a lived experience, or what even in the Christian tradition we would call incarnation. How do you put it into flesh, into your hands, into the real life, the grit and the grime, where the rubber meets the road of actual life? If it doesn't impact that, then your theological musings are rather non-interesting. We're a group of people with diverse opinions on a variety of issues, both social and spiritual. I think it's important to know we make no apology for being overly interested in the life and teachings of Jesus specifically. However, we all differ in how we approach those claims and teachings. At the end of the day, as I think Peter just mentioned, we want to be a beneficial presence in the world. We want this community to not be a self-centered group about personal fulfillment, though that's not a goal, right? We want people to come into personal wholeness, and that's fantastic. But that's not the finish line, personal wholeness. Personal wholeness for the purpose of benefiting the world, the entire biosphere, all of it. Since it's a central, important thing for us. At the end of the day, that's what we want to be, a beneficial presence in this world, as opposed to sort of being consumed with being the kind of community that is fixated on leaving this world for some better place when we die. Some speculative better world. We think that life before death is what spirituality should be primarily focused on. Recognizing that life is a gift, that we didn't dial this up on our own, but that the first word about your life, in fact, is that you have received. That breath you just took, gift. That next breath, gift. And so recognizing that life is a gift and what we do with it, it actually matters. That's what we want to be about. And so today, I want to sort of juxtapose two quotes that I'm going to start with from Barbara Kingsolver and then Oliver Wendell Holmes and expose the tension there and then talk about what do we do with this moving forward. So let me begin with Barbara. She says, the very least you can do in your life is figure out what you hope for. And the most you can do is live inside that hope. And then Oliver Wendell Holmes, if you didn't know the other one, you might be familiar with this one. Some people are so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. Have you heard that one before? So heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. So the first one is about the absolute bottom drawer, right? Is that you got to know what your hope is in. And then the most you can do is actually root yourself, anchor yourself, live inside of that hope. And then the other, which I think the tension is mostly for people who maybe have a Christian background, some people are so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. For a lot of people, religiously, the central hope for them is sort of this certainty about this afterlife transaction. At the end of XYZ, I get, you know, sort of this payout. And that becomes the fixation. And I want to draw that tension and then tease it out a little bit through specifically a story from the Old Testament. When I was going through chemo, you got to pass the time. It's not great. Don't recommend it. Have you heard of the great courses? You can basically go through these lecture series on any incredible topic you want. So I went through like 40 hours of the rise of human civilization, which is fascinating, which made me be like, man, I want to go back and reread the Old Testament. So I did that, and it was just so fun, because if you never read the Old Testament, which is kind of the first two-thirds of the scriptures, it's just a ton of stories, and they're coming from an ancient world, a pre-modern world, a pre-modern worldview, pre-modern writers with their agendas and sensibilities and things like that. But it was fascinating to do that at the same time as I was learning about the rise of human civilization, of course, anthropology and sociology and all the rest of it. But there's a story that stuck out to me that I want to talk about today, and you might be familiar with it. Don't worry, I'll explain it if you have no background in this. But it's called the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel. Let me begin by reading. It's from the book of Genesis, which is right there at the beginning. It says this: "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech." And if you've read Genesis, actually a couple chapters earlier, it talks about how the sons of Noah had spread out and they all had different languages. So that's going to be your problem if you read the Old Testament. It just keeps changing the story a little bit. Like at the beginning, it's like man was created before the animals. And then a little bit later, it's like man was created after the animals. And you got to remember that it's a library of stories that are being pulled together from the ancient world. So any of those types of disagreements, just remember, if you get frustrated, it's probably because you're trying to decide that a god wrote a book and he got confused along the way, and that creates some problems if he's in control, right? That's not what it is. It's a collection. It's a library of stories. What's more interesting is, why did the stories last? What do they mean, and how do they impact our lives today? So the whole world had one language and one common speech. As they migrated from the east, they came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." Now, I remember being taught as a youngster that, you know, they would just point out immediately, "See how arrogant and sinful the people were? They wanted to be like God." First of all, that's an interpretation of what this is saying. When I read this just as it is, I don't see evil here. I see the deep human longing that is in the spirit of every person in this room. There is something about reaching for more. Remember, for a pre-modern person, that three-tiered universe is the way you understand reality. The gods are up, we are down with our limitations. The gods are basically like us without limitation. And then below us, that third level, is, you know, death, Hades, hell, or some sort of evil, right? Because you figured out as human culture moves forward, when people die, they start to smell, and then they sort of melt into the ground over time. You know, so that, you know, death down, control up, and then we're in the middle. That's a three-tiered universe. And so when I read this, all I see is people are they're believing in human potential. And I love that. There's a naive, childlike arrogance that I think is actually praiseworthy. Like my son Ace is 6 years old, and the other day he got just one of those participation medals for flag football. and he was so stoked when he got it, and we were talking to him on the way back. We got in the car, and he gets in the car, and he kicks back. Literally, no, he's not joking at all. He puts his hands behind his back, and he's like, "Finally, I'm the champion of everything." And just like you, we laughed, because I wasn't thinking how arrogant and sinful of him to have a high view of himself, right? And so I think when you read stories like this, especially if you grew up in a Christian tradition, sometimes what happens is you're told what to think, and then you're given the Bible. And I think it's helpful to try and let go of everything they told you everything means and just read it. Because I read, oh man, that's like me. Like, whatever, I don't know what it is for you. How have you tried to build a tower to God? For me, I remember it was like, I'm going to read my way to enlightenment. And those of you who know me know I read like crazy. But there was a time in my life when I was like convinced I was only 100 books away from, I'm going to get it, you know, I'm going to get God. And it's like, just this desperation. But we all do it in different ways. You know, I'm going to be super good at yoga or whatever. I'm going to finally achieve inner peace through this bridge, this thing, perfect theology, great church attendance, you know, 10% exactly before tax to my church, whatever it is that we think we're going to do, whatever ladder or, you know, religious system that we're going to execute, we're going to get there somehow. And there it is right in the text. How true is this story? I just know it's true in me. I'm building a tower oftentimes, much to my own dismay. So the way the story goes is, we'll just skip ahead and say that the gods, or God in plural in this case, come down to confuse the language of the people and scatter them over the earth. So obviously, I think it goes without saying, but let me say it. It's an origin myth to help people explain why are there so many other tribes? You know, how did this all happen? And basically, you find this story throughout the earth. In fact, in ways that predate the biblical narrative as well. The Sumerian culture has a Tower of Babel myth. Ancient Babylon has one. This guy named Fraser, who's an anthropologist and has studied all this stuff, he identifies similar myths of the, you know, the spreading of languages and the gods confusing the languages in ancient Greece, people groups in Kenya, Australia, West Asia, the Madu of California, the Tlingit of Alaska, and the Quiche Maya of Guatemala, which I find fascinating. Like, we're all just reaching out for these explanations for, you know, the way things are and to explain our worldview, and it's not surprising that it sounds very pre-modern, but what's more important is the truths that are embedded in the narrative. I'm not really concerned about if you believe it's this one's literal and all the other ones are, those are myths, okay, and that's fine, or you think it's, you know, definitely a myth, irrelevant. The question is, what are the truths in there that speak to our current reality? And I think there are many deeper truths, not only our purpose as a species, but warnings to heed about the missteps in pursuing our own types of spirituality. I think it suggests, underneath all of our differences, this is an important one, that we're really one race. That's a wonderful truth of this story, that at the end of the day, that we begin as one, which is true evolutionarily, we know this, that we come from the source of life together, and that, secondly, that our diversity is sort of part of this. What makes life work is diversity. It's not an add-on later. Without diversity, life can't flourish. That's a beautiful truth. And then third, and this is what I want to focus on today from the story, is the story suggests that our job is here. It's on earth. It's not to build a tower to the heavens, to escape the world, or to become the gods, lower like the gods, but it's to be here. It's to be rooted in the here and now, right here on the earth. Not to focus our time and our energies on getting to this heaven somewhere far away. It's about this life here and now, living it as fully as we can. Just like the central Christian prayer even states, thy will be done, thy kingdom come on, do you know it? On earth, absolutely. A place right here with us, with the real people. And our job is not to become like gods, but to learn what it means to be fully human. That's why I love that Jesus, the title he kept giving himself was the Son of the Human One or the Son of Man. This idea, I love the idea that in some ways, you know, the universe gets to a point where it can do a Jesus. And so Jesus is sort of this incredible model of what it means to be a human being. You know, we might be Homo sapiens, but the distance between Homo sapien and human has to become this embodied life of self-sacrifice for others. To let go of our attachments and our frantic survival needs to survive over other people, right? So that we can become the kinds of people who live in love, who are constantly giving away and giving away, and even pushed far enough, would give our own lives away to be killed at the hands of even perhaps our enemies praying forgiveness over them because they don't understand what they're doing. That's enlightenment. And I see that so beautifully and exceptionally demonstrated in the Jesus story. What we're doing here at Eastlake is, and I think in metaphors, is we're building like a mole box nursery, okay? That's one. Or a laboratory to love, a cathedral to God and the human spirit. My friend Felina Hewerts, she put a book out about 5 years ago called Pilgrimage of a Soul, and it just got re-released. I'd recommend it to you if you're at all interested. I love how she describes it. She says this, the all-pervasive quality of love in one's life is the only probable indication that one is living in a state of union with God. I love that. Again, the idea is really simple, that to be connected to God means that you love. And that, again, the scriptures speak to this as well. Anyone who loves knows God. I don't know if your mean religious uncle ever told you that verse, but it's in the Bible. Anyone who loves knows God. That's what she's talking about. And the litmus test, actually Peter has mentioned it in his messages before. I'm going to screw it up. He says, Christ is our model, love is our metric. There it is. Christ is our model, love is our metric. It's the fruit of our lives that says whether or not we are living in union with ultimate reality or God or love. And too often, a church that is overly focused on heaven in the next life communicates subtly that this world is not important, or even worse, that it's evil. Some of you maybe grew up in traditions where the world is just this evil place. So basically, if you see trouble or difficulty or you point out injustice, don't really worry about that primarily, because everything's going to be fine in the next life. You know, when we get to heaven, everything will be fine, and so we don't have to engage really. I mean, we can, but don't worry about it. The big picture, the big game, the final everything is somewhere else. And you can see that doesn't probably create the kind of people who are going to actively engage at the same level. Wrapped up in that same kind of theology is the idea that even our bodies are somehow tainted or corrupt, and our spirits are filled with sin from the moment of our birth. Such a theology takes one of the most beautiful miracles, the birth of a child, and can cover it in guilt and shame. Religions that focus on escaping the earth like this lean not only on the hope of heaven, but there's a dark side to it as well, on the fear of hell. So the hope of heaven isn't so much about the hope of heaven. It's like the hope of not going to hell, also heaven, yes, right? Some of you are like, this is what I grew up in, right? So yes, it's the fear of hell. In order to scare people, and it's very effective to scare people into believing or behaving a certain way or giving a certain percentage of their income, because if you don't give this pre-tax, then you're out of the blessing zone and God can't bless you. Did you guys know that yet? If you don't give Eastlake a certain amount of money, I can't promise you a long and healthy, wealthy life. So, yeah, okay, good. We all know that's garbage. All right. I wish it would be. It's very motivating if you can convince people of this. It's not helpful. The fear as a motivator. In fact, Peter and I were talking about this earlier this week, that in the tradition he grew up in October every year, they would do something for the kids called a hell house. I'd never even heard of such a thing. They did hell houses, which is basically their way of being like, we don't worship Halloween, but we scare the out of kids. And we take them through hell and say, now, before you leave, make sure you're the right religion so you don't get sent there by a God of love. Which is a little bit confusing. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that we should love kids instead of scare them. Radical idea. But I mean that, I didn't mean, you know, jokingly, but now let me rephrase it sincerely. What is going to produce a healthy child who's going to grow up to a responsible, loving adult? Is it fear? Is it threat of punishment? Or is it love, acceptance, loving guidance? This is what children need. We don't need to scare the hell out of kids. We need to love them into human wholeness. Jesus said, love your neighbor, love your enemy. He didn't say, also scare the hell out of anyone, okay? I love, Adi Ashanti says it this way. To have eyes to see the divinity in all beings is to bring light to this world. That is quite a contrast to some of the theologies I've been describing. So in contrast to that, a church that is focused on this life and this world does not fill people's heads with foreboding images of a hell, God's torture chamber for the unbelievers, but it would be the kind of community in a church that is concerned with the very real and material hells on earth that are right now a part of our world. Not some horrific speculation about what happens after you die, but hells we can see with our own eyes, like hunger, poverty, discrimination, abuse, addiction, war, real hells that we all are well acquainted with. This is what a church community should put its resources and energy and attention focusing on to do the work of redemption toward, rather than trying to terrorize people into some notion of a nightmarish afterlife. Because otherwise, a church is just a tower of Babel. And any message focused primarily on escaping this world is just that. It's a bunch of Babel. Probably a better translation from the Hebrew would be bullshit. But that's my own thing. Maybe you guys heard of the guy who died and went to heaven. He's getting a tour from St. Peter. You know, there's a lunch room. This is where you get the jet skis checked out. And then they're going by this hallway. And this first room, the door's open. There's all these people running around dancing and breaking plates. And St. Peter's like, oh, yeah, that's the Greek Orthodox. These guys are great. You'll love them. And they keep going, and they take a little bit, walk further down, and the next door's open, and there's these guys running around in orange robes, and they're giggling and laughing and chanting, and he's like, oh, the Buddhists, these guys are great. And they go to they'll go past the next room, and the door's open, and these guys are sitting down, and they're debating hotly. It seems like they're arguing, but after a while, you see, oh, they're just passionate about this. They're talking about theology and meaning and human suffering and all these different things, and he's like, oh, the Jews, man, these guys are thinkers. You're going to like these guys. And then they're about to continue down, and St. Peter's like, ooh, just a second. This next door we're going to walk by, we need to be very quiet. And they're like, okay. Well, so they walk by silently, and they pass by the door and keep going. And the guy's like, okay, what was with that last, who's in that last room? And he's like, oh, that's the evangelicals. They still think they're the only ones in here. Now, besides that being hilarious, what I'm trying to say is, anytime, whether it's us or any other group, tries to act like we have the exclusive ticket on truth or heaven or, you know, whatever, we have distilled God down to the essence of what you must know, then that's just a little arrogant and unhelpful, that we can begin to put limits on the limitless, that we can put form on the formless. We get ourselves into trouble. And if we are trying to be a community that is bringing this notion of heaven to earth, which is what Jesus was talking about, that's why he says the kingdom is within you. It's not a place we're going to go. He's saying it manifests here. Who knows what happens after this? But that the kingdom is within you, if Jesus says that, then the kingdom of love, the kingdom of justice, the kingdom of God, it emerges and erupts into the real whenever you make a decision for love. Whenever you find yourself at a crossroads of a choice, what does love do here? When you make that choice, Christ returns and the kingdom engages. It is ever emerging. We don't need to wait for some apocalyptic one world government and then Jesus is going to come out of the sky. Christ returns in the human. This is what the body of Christ means. We are the body of Christ. And Christ returns insofar as every time we have the option to choose love, justice, forgiveness, compassion, long-suffering, abundant generosity, Christ returns. And we are participating in the renewal of the world in those things. So heaven, this idea of heaven is a beautiful, idealized notion about what a just human society could be. We must hang on to the idea of heaven for that very reason, because we must build this kind of place in the here and now for not only our own enjoyment, but friends, as privileged people on the earth, especially in relation to human history, it is us who have an immense power to create an equitable world for all, especially the most vulnerable. So what would that look like? Well, it would have to be a place where nobody's left out, cast aside, or turned away, where nobody is taken advantage of, where no child is ever abused, raped, cheated, or maligned, a place where peace reigns, where forgiveness and compassion are the very air we breathe, where unity of heart and purpose is the very fabric of the culture, regardless of sexual orientation, skin pigmentation, creed, culture, or class. Good religion, healthy spirituality, emerging, expanding souls. Communities like this should be focused on building such a world. And it will be a struggle, and it will be two steps forward, one step back, and we will fail along the way again and again. But we're not focused on a speculation about what happens when we die, but one just world that we are actively pursuing and creating here and now, in our own ways, in our own spaces, in our own relationships, at home, at work, and in every small area in which we have a little bit of influence. And if a church community is not interested in those things, or those things come in a distant second to making sure you have a list of the correct theological concepts agreed upon in your head so you can go to the good place, waiting for the Jesus spaceship to return to take the good folks like us away from God's enemies so he can destroy the earth, if that's all we're doing, then a church is just a bunch of babble. A church like that is just a tower to nowhere. I used to have more, but I have some friends who are pastors. And one of them I've known forever, and he's an evangelical pastor, and we stay connected, and we go on walks, and we debate, you know, we talk about stuff, but we do it in a loving way. Like, I'm convinced that, like, he has some unhelpful views about life and even about himself. And I'm like, this will be so healing for you. And he's like, you're crazy, you know, and you're going to hell and stuff like that. So it's a wonderful relationship. But I remember recently we were on this walk, and we love each other sincerely, but I remember one thing he said was, man, one thing I don't get is if I was where you're at, like you hold so many things as unknowns. And he's like, if I was where you were at, one thing I definitely wouldn't do is lead a church. I now see that funny. I didn't laugh when he said it, but I get it now. I get it now. Because basically he was saying like, you know, if you're not have the right beliefs, like heaven, like it's about heaven, like this world is crazy and like it's about this, you know, having those, making sure you get in and things like that. And I said, well, I just don't know. You know, there's different ways to look at Jesus. And he's like, well, I don't get it, man. I'm with Paul. Like if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then I don't get it, the whole point. And I just said, dude, I think you have a low view of Jesus. Like I don't have like a problem. Like I don't know what happened. I can't tell you. Like 2,000 years ago, I was born in 1978. It's like I don't know what happened when Jesus was around. I don't. But I'm totally open to it. You know what I mean? Like I'm not closed. I just don't know. I don't claim knowledge that I don't actually have. And I said, if Jesus doesn't matter to you unless he can get you to heaven, then I think you have a low view of Jesus. I would follow Jesus whether he's supernatural or super normal. Because the way of Jesus, the road of abundant generosity, nonviolent peacemaking, this is healing. This will heal the world. People who live the path of Christ are going to do good works. They're going to heal their own wounds, and they're going to heal the wounds of the world. So having a low, if Jesus is just your ticket to heaven, and you wouldn't follow him unless he's taken you there, then I don't think you really have a high view of Jesus. The point is not getting into heaven. The point is the kingdom. The point is love. The point is beauty and goodness and redemption. That's the point. And to be honest, over the years, I've gotten a lot of sort of garbage from people. Sometimes I wish I could be like, yeah, I'm not a Christian. Because then the people who are kind of the most like chippy at me would like leave me alone. They're like, see, I told you, you know, and they'd be happy about it. So sometimes I wish I could be like, yeah, I don't believe any of that. But I can't. I can't get away from Jesus. There's just no way. I will never not have a crush on Jesus. It's just not going to happen. You know, he's my first. And I, the path and practice, the cycle, death, burial, resurrection, all of this stuff speaks to my life at a depth level that I can't get away from. The truth of the Jesus story is the most important thing to me. And I'll never be able to get away from it. That doesn't mean I don't learn from other traditions. I don't think all religions are saying the same thing. In fact, to say that, you have to not read them. And I have. They're not saying the same thing. But they're complementary things. In fact, I was thinking the other day about, I had this dream of Buddha and Jesus talking over tea. And I just could imagine them like, ooh, that's good. I like that. Like, I never thought of that. Like, they're just going back and forth because there's a lot of complementary stuff there. So for the Buddha, and this is a super overgeneralization, but it's this sort of move of up and out. It's the transcending of the human, to leave behind the false self, the small self, the ego, the attachments. So in many ways, Buddha is saying to humanity, and rightly so, much of your suffering is optional. And depending on how old you are, you know that's true at a deeper level, right? Much of the things you cling to, the suffering that you have, is things you could just let go of, needing to be in control or have these things or who you think you are. Much of human suffering is optional. But I don't think that's complete. I don't think that anybody's spiritual map, like this is the Buddhist one or whatever, is complete. The Jesus move is the whole other way. It's not just the up and out, which I think Jesus taught as well, by the way. It's not just the up and out. It's the down and in. The incarnation is like the central point of Jesus-centered spirituality. It's that the divine is in the human. It drives you back into the world. Jesus' spirituality doesn't say, you're done. Now go sit cross-legged on the top of a mountain far away from people. That's not Jesus' spirituality. Jesus' spirituality says, back into the world. Engage with the wound. So while the Buddha might say much of human suffering is optional, Jesus would say, oh, so true. And then he would say, but some suffering is non-optional. This is what the cross is about. Some suffering is non-optional. In fact, some suffering is absolutely central to your further transformation. Now we could go around the room and talk about the crappiest thing that happened to you. And depending on how far behind you it is, probably most of us would say, and yet it's made me who I am. So there's this whole cycle. And both are essential. The up and out and the down and in. So when we say, or when I say that love is hopefully the spirit of this church, I'm not talking about some wimpy, hippy, dippy, let's all sing hands, you know, or sing hands, let's all hold hands and sing kumbaya. I'm talking about a love that's gritty and hard and painful. It's courage creating, it's hope building, self-sacrificial love, but it is afflicted. And it's unwilling to just escape the world. It embraces the reality that some suffering is non-optional. Sometimes it's just holding space with a friend who's suffering. Some of it is non-optional. A love that takes seriously the words of Christ, that what you have done for the least of these, you have done to me. We're building a community of love that can endure bitterness and despair without caving to defeat. And if we try to build a tower to heaven to deny our humanity or deny our mortality or to not deny the world's pain or the insanity of our current situation in the world right now, that might be tempting, but it's not true, it's not honest, it's not real, and it's not really living. And it's not what the wise and the good have discovered and tried to pass along to us in their lives and in their teachings. I was reading the Tao, actually William Martin's translation of the Tao, earlier this week in the morning, and I love this. Let me read it to you. It says, some older people despair from having seen too much, heard too much, and felt too much. The mind has become clouded with sorrow and fear. There is no more room for hopes and dreams. But the sage is always releasing things, releasing thoughts, releasing fears, releasing expectations. In the sage's mind, there is always room for life. Is that true of you today? Is there room for life in that situation that looks hopeless? Is there still room for life at the end of that dead end that you feel like you're in? Because you gotta find it. Human beings cannot survive without hope. And if you have a friend who feels like that cul-de-sac is all there is, you have to help point where the hope is. That there's still life on the other end of this thing, and that's why we need community. We take seriously our job to inspire one another here. We take seriously our job as a church to grow the souls of people so that we are not constricting whenever we feel pain, but instead that even though something tragic may happen to us, that we would expand instead. That we would open our hearts, not close down. Helping people discover who they truly are, what their contribution is to be in the world, not cramming some worldview or theology down their throat, but helping fan into flame what's already inside of them. And to be a supportive environment for them to explore their own spirituality. People need a framing story about who they are and what they should put their hope in. And that's what we want to do. We want to provide a framing narrative that allows people to look to their past with gratitude instead of shame. To say, that was painful, but it has shaped me, and here's how I'm redeeming it. To look to the future with hope instead of despair. Is that something the world needs right now? Is that something our country needs? A framing narrative that can allow us to look to the future with hope? Absolutely. And then inspiration to engage the present to address the issues that face us. Eastlake, we should be inspiring one another every week, every day, to live with integrity and courage and character, helping one another become generous with our resources, to learn how to value our differences and sit with discomfort without shrinking back. Let's be the kind of community that's open to being proven wrong, to continually dropping another version of our worldview. Oh, crap, I was wrong again. That's the kind of community I want to be a part of. I want to be a community that teaches each other how to love and how to forgive, how to say thank you, how to apologize when it's necessary. I hope that's what we're teaching our kids back here. I don't really give a rip if they learn Bible stories, if they don't learn how to say, I'm sorry, or how to extend forgiveness. I forgive you. These are the lessons of God's love that must be loved, children must be loved into in our community. I hope that's true. And so in many ways, I think this is our time. Now, I don't think ever before really has this kind of community been more necessary, where we have things much more openly held because we center on the values of love. That's the center here for us. And I think now is the time. Like, now is our time. I feel like Malf and the Goonies. It's our time. It's our time down here, man. This is mine. I'm taking it back. No, not that part. I think Jesus, the historical Jesus, would have us build a church that centered on the only thing he not only spoke about but demonstrated over and over in his words and in his ways, about the perennial and eternal vision of a reign of equitable justice, peace by nonviolent means, and love as the ultimate expression of forgiveness and reconciliation. Rather than fixating on correct beliefs about Jesus, we want to cultivate a path and a practice in the way of Jesus. What way is that? It's the countercultural road of limitless forgiveness, radical acceptance, nonviolent peacemaking, abundant generosity, and sacrificial love. I need to wrap it up. Let's stand as I do. There's a section in the Gospels where Jesus is quoted. Some of you may have grown up hearing this, where Jesus said, the harvest is ready, but the workers are few. Anybody familiar with that at all? You ever heard that? A couple of us. I was told when I was growing up that meant there's tons of people out there who are just dying to become Christians like us, but nobody's courageous or loves God enough to go pray at the flagpole after school or, you know, go to a different country and tell them they need our religion. As if Jesus was like, you know, actually thinking that, like, oh man, I wish somebody would go give these people the right theology. If you read it in context, right before that, it says that Jesus, his heart's broken because the people are harassed and helpless. This is the problem with reading the Bible as an American, or in my case, especially as a white male. It's like, it doesn't get any more privileged than me. The problem is the whole Bible is written from the perspective of the marginalized. And so if you forget that Jesus is talking about a group of people who have the boot of empire on their necks, they are oppressed and held down. And Jesus said, the people are harassed and helpless, and the workers are few. He's like, we want to invite you into what we feel like we've been invited to, which is to work for a just world. And we are not going to complete the work, but that does not excuse us from beginning it. You are invited to live a life of love for the redemption of your own heart and the world. And that is virtuous work. Even if it means you don't have the corner on truth or the ticket to heaven, it's worth doing. It's worth loving. And it's worth working towards a just, equitable, and generous world. Would you agree? Yeah, because life is a gift, and love is the point. That's right. Let me leave you with this benediction. Check it out. It's from a hymn I ran across this week, and we'll leave. Give us, O God, the strength to build the city that hath stood too long a dream, whose laws are love, whose crown is servanthood, and where the sun that shineth is God's grace for human good. I'm pretty sure we'll be here next week. Otherwise, we'll see you.